This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My guest today is Kevin Plexico of Deltek. Kevin, long time, man.
Hey, well, thanks for having me out.
You bet. What's new at Deltek?
I've got a couple things going on. We just introduced a new CRM solution for government contractors. It's a web-based application that we introduced just in January that's really designed for small and mid-sized companies that that are looking to track their opportunities in their pipeline in a centralized place. And it kind of supports the things the government contractors need to do with CRM versus some of the more generic CRM solutions.
Okay.
And we acquired a new HR people management application business called HR Smart that we're going to be introducing.
I saw that one. I didn't hear about the CRM thing, but I saw the other. What does that add to the equation?
Well, we you know, it's one of our areas that we see as a big opportunity is the integration of people management and recruiting, since that's so much a key part of what government contractors do, the whole recruiting aspect and then the performance management aspect and tying that into our accounting and financial management systems we see as a real critical cog to us going forward.
Okay. Well, does it tie into LinkedIn? Because LinkedIn is huge on that recruiting front.
I think there's some connections in there as well as some of the other recruiting tools out there.
Oh, yeah. It's got to tie into a lot of things. But I know that's an area, a huge area of interest for whoever runs things at LinkedIn. So let's start talking about the current lay of the land from your perspective. What's going on in GovCon that people should start paying attention to if they're not already?
Well, I think the key thing that we've seen the last couple of years because of the bipartisan budget agreement, we've got some stability and predictability in spending that we've had last year and this year, and finally in the civilian sector in particular, we've seen a return to growth, albeit very slow and modest growth, but at least a return to growth. The defense sector still probably has another year or two of some challenges, though, based on the discussions on the Hill and the president's budget request. Looks like DOD might get back to growth here in 2016, 2017, and I think that's going to be a big swing, kind of just a return to some positive energy and positive environment in the market. Obviously, we have to get over the specter of the sequester that's going to be reemerging here in the summer. I think that'll be the topic of discussion for most of the summer. We'll see if Congress can get that off the table or not.
What about spending at DHS? Is that going to settle down? Have they gotten by the immigration issue?
Well, I don't know if they've gotten by the immigration issue, but they got funding for the year, and it's slightly above last year. So I think they're going to be in good shape as well if you're a DHS contractor.
Okay. M&A, number one, it's slight uptick, seeming uptick anyway. Some deals that are pretty notable. What does this do to the landscape in general?
Well, I think we always have M&A has been a part of this market for so long. And I remember, you know, when I first came into the market, there was this speculation that M&A was kind of, we're going to lead to this huge consolidation of the industry. There's going to be fewer players. And
only 20.
Yeah. The fact of the matter is, because of the small business rules and regulations and set-aside programs, you always have this emergence of people who came out of some of those large businesses who start up a small one, and then they grow, and they get to be a certain size, and at some point they sell off. And so I almost feel like there's this constant influx of new businesses and acquisitions that are chewing up and gobbling up certain businesses as they get to a certain size. So I haven't seen anything major in terms of changes in the industry from that point of view. I think what we do see is when there's uncertainty in the budget environment like we had in 2013, that really put a damper on M&A. If you were a company that was considering selling, that's probably the worst time to sell because you have no way to communicate confidence in the business going forward. Yeah. And if you're a buyer, you're also reluctant to overpay for something. So I think that uncertainty creates some stagnation in the M&A world. And then when we got through that in 2014, it picked up a bit.
Okay. The Vistronics, the CEO spoke at, I think it was the Fairfax Chamber a couple weeks ago, six deals over 2 years, and they looked to be very particular kinds of deals, filling in maybe chinks in their armor. Have you noticed any great measure of success when a company fills in the blanks that way?
Well, I think I have seen certainly a lot of companies that have been successful with acquisitions and a number that have failed as well. But, you know, what our CEO describes it this way. You can hike Mount Everest or you can take a helicopter and drop you off at the top. One's going to cost you a lot more, but it's going to get you there a lot faster. And I think that's the way a lot of companies in this business think about M&A. If I'm looking to expand my capability in cybersecurity or health IT or some of the other, we'll say, hot segments of the market, you know, the fastest way to get there is through acquisition. But obviously, you have to manage the acquisition and the integration effectively for it to pay off in the long run. And that's just like execution on a market entry strategy. It's just a different kind of execution.
Yeah, but then you get a company like Leidos that sells a division. They sold Cloud Shield Tech, you know, divesting certain things. And Leidos itself spun off from SAIC. I don't know. It's kind of confusing, at least from the outside, that all of these things are taking place, and yet the landscape here, you know, there's very, very, almost no ripples in the water during the process.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons companies will sell a business, right? So one is maybe it's just not a fit within the context of the rest of the business. So some of these large integration companies end up buying things, and they come with other things that they don't necessarily want to buy with the acquisition, but it's kind of part of it. And then at some point you find a way to gracefully extract it or sell it off to an organization or spin it off in a way that you think it can generate more value by itself or with another organization. And I think that's a motivation for the splitting. Obviously, another reason for the acquisitions that we've seen, thinking of some of the bigger ones, has been because of the economies of scale of bringing like businesses together and leveraging the back office systems infrastructure to generate margin when some of these business lines that they're in are pretty low margin businesses. You're trying to find every ounce of margin you can get.
Any way you can make it, yes. One deal in particular I've written about three times now. I did twice on LinkedIn posts. And one that'll be out in Wash Tech, the Aero buying Immix deal. Did that cause any speculation over at Dell Tech that you could talk about publicly?
Well, I don't know if there's any speculation. I found it fascinating. I was actually having lunch with Art Richer about 3 or 4 days before I heard the news, and he's a good poker player because it certainly didn't come up in the conversation. But I found it to be a really interesting acquisition when you consider Aero as a distributor buying what is like a reseller, kind of very much
value
like a reseller.
Added,
yeah,
almost a VAD of value-added distributor.
Yeah,
but,
and then figuring out how those two kind of link together and the supply chain around that, it's kind of an interesting acquisition, I think.
Yeah, it was interesting to me because traditionally the distributors, you know, Ingram Tech Data, Avnet, Aero, Westcon, you know, all of the above, Synnex, have maintained a serious arm's length from direct business with the government. Ingram, a couple of years ago, bought ProMark, which was kind of an interesting deal because ProMark is very small distributor, but they don't sell direct to government. They sell to the reseller community. Immix, though, sells direct. They supply the 800-plus resellers, plus they represent 200 manufacturers. The Aero gig allows them probably the ability to cherry-pick from that 100,000 companies that Aero distributes to or for. It's a game changer.
Well, the one thing I would say is all the distributors have been and are continue to actively look for ways to help the companies that they distribute for be successful, find ways to be successful in the markets that they're selling into, whether that be by providing market intelligence or data or leads, et cetera. And that's essentially what Immix Group does for a lot of its clients, is help them to be successful, help them to find opportunities and sell. And so I think that's kind of an interesting opportunity where this distributor saying, well, maybe we get closer to that because that can help us help our the companies we help sell be more successful.
Right. And you know, one of the interesting things about MX2 is they have two blogs that I know of, maybe more, but one of the blogs talks about the opportunities and how to exploit them, but it's not a private blog, it's a public blog.
Right.
So,
as blogs should be.
Well, I agree. It's one of the reasons that I've migrated to publishing more on LinkedIn. But that, I mean, you know, that one's going to be fun to watch because, again, like the other acquisitions, the surface of the water will stay the same. The tides underneath that water, I think, are going to start shifting. And I'm very curious to know if DLT or Carahsoft has had any subsequent discussions with distributors as a result. And I doubt if either of the CEOs will call me. DLT just got bought, too.
Yeah, by a private equity, right?
Yeah, from one private equity to another, TZP to Milstein.
Mm-hmm.
So, the typical run for private equity owning a company, at least in this market, is about 5 years, and it's been 2 months. So, unless it's a really sweet deal, I don't see that happening.
That would be hard to move that quickly.
Hard to move that quickly. We're going to take a quick break here. My guest is Kevin Plexico. Kevin is with you're the EVP of what?
No, I'm the Vice President of Information Solutions over at Dell Tech.
There you go. Should be EVP. Tell him I told you to give him a raise.
I'll mention that when I get back to the office.
There you go. I don't know your boss anymore, but, you know, whatever. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM back after this. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. If I hadn't mentioned that before, I don't think I had. That's me. My guest today is Kevin Plexico, Vice President at Dell Tech. And number one, if people don't know Kevin, he's had basically one job his whole career. His company was one of those acquired, so it was an M&A thing. But same position, same company. He's the guy that tracks all of the numbers on all of the contracts, and that's where we're going now. Let's start at the 50,000 foot view with current vehicles. What's going on out there? What's hot?
Well, all the attention on contracts these days is on contract vehicles versus contracts for specific work. You know, it used to be you'd have these major systems integration contracts that were awarded to a single vendor, and there was this whole dance of a multi-year acquisition environment and the capture processes that companies go through, and that's really changed. Yeah, well, we still have those, but that's all changed, and now all the big contracts are contract vehicles that are IDIQs. Whether they be the GWACs like the Alliant out of GSA or the agency-specific IDIQs. And so a lot of the focus is on Alliant 2 and what they're going to do with the follow-on GWAC to Alliant. That's the GSA program, obviously. And then the Army has a couple that are going on, the ITES 3S, which is the third iteration, obviously, the third iteration of the Army ITES mm-hmm. program for IT services. And then you also have the RS3 contract, which is really a professional services contract and logistics work, that type of work that's supporting the Army. That's a consolidation of a number of contract vehicles.
Okay.
So those are some of the big ones that we're hearing about. Obviously, SOOP and SOOP 5, the follow-on to SOOP 4 is a big one that we're waiting for with the protest being in play there. That's delaying the transition there, and they're talking about extending.
I don't think there were that many protesters, actually, so it wouldn't surprise me to see them simply folded in as necessary.
Kumbaya, come on in, we'll get this done.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, Joanne runs a great ship, and from everywhere I hear, it is customer service oriented on both sides of the fence. So the government buyers and the contractors that actually win, you know, appending something to your vehicle as a contractor is a matter of hours, not weeks or months. For the buying community, it is the least expensive vehicle out there and the most efficient.
Yeah, we always have this debate, and mainly it's driven by GSA trying to centralize, reduce the number of GWACs, and have them really kind of manage the GWACs as a central organization. But I think the competition really helps. And I'll give a good example. SOOP 4 was blowing it out of the water for a long time and really eating the lunch of the GSA Schedule 70. And it looked like the GSA Schedule 70s were going by the wayside. And I think it forced the GSA to be more thoughtful, more customer-oriented, better at managing the schedules. And we've finally seen the schedules start to turn around. So, I think that's really a good thing. I think it's been helpful to have some of the competition between agencies for these contracts. Just like this, it's helpful to have competition on the contracts themselves.
It's a good thing, but, you know, it goes back to then GSA Administrator Loretta Doan saying, you know, soup should be under our roof. You know, to most of the market, that was simply a laughable concept because, mm-hmm. oh, we'll bring you down to our level, not bringing you over will take us up, you know, just...
Well, you're absolutely right, though. Soup has been regarded as a much more easy to work with contract vehicle in terms of things like pricing changes and getting products on and just flexibility and speed of getting orders processed, that kind of thing, versus the schedules. So I think the schedules have had to respond to that.
Yeah, but it's not a one-stop shop. Schedules still have a lot more services than soups. It's any services that apply to the soup vehicle have to be directly related to the products that are sold. And the services side is capped on Soup 5 at what, 15%, something like that?
I don't know the amount, but it's definitely not a services-oriented contract vehicle. And GSA Schedule 70 does have a big component of it that is services, pure professional services.
I just remember a conversation I had with Max Peterson once. He was then at CDW. He's now over at Amazon. And when he was at CDW, he said, you know, he was VP of Federal Sales. He said, you know, all we need here is that trifecta of contracts. We need that schedule. We need soup and we need the NIH vehicle. And I forget which one it was at the time. But he said from those three vehicles, anybody in government can access what we at CDW offer.
So, that is true. It's true.
So
the first two are obviously the much bigger ones.
Yeah. Well, there is that. But, you know, he wanted that trifecta. And I just what a great term. So are there any other big GWACs or IDIQs out there that people may not know the numbers for that are interesting?
Well,
good numbers are bad.
Yeah, Alliant quietly, you know, Alliant got off to a really slow start, mm-hmm. But since then it's actually gotten pretty active. I think in 2014 it did about $3.5 billion, and so the GWACs have come back a little bit. But I sort of feel like if you look at GSA schedules, the GWACs and the agency-specific IDIQs, we've sort of hit a bit of an equilibrium in terms of how they're all used. We used to see big swings, like it was all going to the agency-specific IDIQs when we had Eagle and we had Army ITES and Seaport and some of the other vehicles that are military-specific. It seemed like all the money was moving to the agency-specific vehicles. And then the last couple of years, the GSA Schedule 70 and the GWACs have started to take on a larger percentage, and the agency-specific IDIQs have started to fall off a little bit. But I feel like we're probably just at a little bit of a transition. If you think about Eagle 2 coming online, mm-hmm. Army ITES S3 or 3S coming on, I think we're going to see a shift back, but I don't see any major changes in that. I think we're kind of finally at a bit of an equilibrium between the balance and the vehicles.
On the Eagle, is that primarily a DHS vehicle?
Yeah, it's really mainly totally. A DHS vehicle, just like the T4 contract is for the VA.
And that was something else that GSA had talked about, not just in the current administration, but previously, is the proliferation. OMB has weighed in, the proliferation of agency-specific vehicles. Why aren't they buying off the other GWACs, particularly the GSA ones? Are we still going to see from the larger agencies those types of contracts?
I definitely think we are. I think, you know, we've seen the what's the way to put it? The discussion and the debate about whether they're appropriate or not. And I remember mm-hmm. they had the same discussion when the CIOSP mm-hmm. 3 contract was seeking approval to be a GWAC, and they were going through the process of justifying why it was an important vehicle and why they needed it. And I, you know, you see OMB kind of always questioning it, but they still at the end of the day approve it. And I think the same will happen with some of the defense specific contract vehicles. They still have, you know, just an incredible contracting acquisition shops that can manage those types of vehicles. So there's really no reason for them to waste those resources on relying on GSA contracts where they have less of those types of people in some cases. So I see there's going to continue to be a need for it. What I see is that the agencies that are going to rely more on the GSA vehicles, at least in terms of a percentage of spending, is going to be like the Department of Education, Housing and Urban Development, the organizations that don't have a large contracting shop to stand up their own vehicle. They're going to rely more on GSA.
Okay. What about new vehicles coming down the pike?
Well, we talked about Soup.
Yeah.
I think that one will be interesting to watch if it has the same success and ramp up that Soup 4 did when it was initially awarded.
One would assume this one's going to be hot from the gate.
Yeah, and Soup, I think the other one is Eagle 2, which we're waiting to see how that starts to ramp up.
Mm-hmm.
That will be another one that I think will take on a lot of DHS spending, though DHS isn't growing the way it was before. And then the other one, obviously, to watch is the T4 follow-on in VA. So all these vehicles are now continuing with recompetes. There's very few kind of brand new contract vehicles. We're on twos and threes and fours of all these vehicles. And so that's what you really have to pay attention to is kind of by agency, what is the contract vehicle or vehicles of choice or preference for them? And how do you make sure that you align to those? To your point about Max's comments of having those three, well, if you're doing business in the VA, none of those three are going to help you very much. Maybe the Soup contract would, because they were big users of that, but they now have their own commodity contract, and the same would go for DHS. So you have to kind of just pay attention to what is the agency's buying practices, what contract vehicles do they prefer, and how are you going to align to them if you really want to do business with that organization.
Okay. We're going to take a break. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Kevin Plexico. Kevin is the Vice President of Research.
Sure.
There you go. Executive Vice President, soon to be CEO.
Yeah, right.
you can find him at deltech.com. You can also find Kevin on LinkedIn, and I suggest you do. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, how do you track, you know, let's say, you know, Eagle 1's dying, Eagle 2's coming. How soon should you follow it? What does it mean to a small business? Alliant has its own small business vehicle. How do you start queuing up these things? Let me start with a different example. About 3 years ago, a company contacted me and said they were interested in Soup. It's a very small reseller. And I said, well, you know, number one, I'm glad you're calling now and not like a month before the award. So I gave them some generic instruction, and I gave them some tasks, and they familiarized themselves with the vehicle. We did, oddly enough, we did a search on LinkedIn, and we were looking for people who had helped other companies on Soup 3 and 4, particularly outside consultants, or people who had worked at the companies who were no longer at the companies. We found a couple of those, so we got them as advisors to the company, and they actually won the pre-protest Soup 5. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think these contract vehicles have they have a cycle to them. They get awarded, they generally ramp up really quickly, and then somewhere around halfway through their contract, or maybe 2 years, 3 years before the expiration of the contracts, you start to see a slowdown, particularly if they're the services contracts. You start to see a slowdown because the agencies don't want to award a task order for a year or 2 years. They want to award a multi-year task order so they're not competing it again soon. And so the work will start to wind down. And that's the point when the agency's thinking, we got to figure out what we're going to do with the next vehicle so we have some continuity here. And that's the time when I think companies need to engage. And part of that engagement is obviously the generic answer is you want to be involved as early as possible because you want to have a chance to meet with the agency, communicate what you'd like to see in terms of how the vehicle shapes up, make sure you're expressing your perspective and opinion on how you'd like a vehicle to shape, because how it gets shaped can have a big impact on how you approach it.
Right. And, you know, getting on their radar is not always the easiest thing. So attending any meetings that the agency has or the contract has certainly is useful. There seems to be a lot fewer of those. You know, the Soup contract for a number of years had its own conference, and I was lucky enough to speak at one of those. And it was the first time I had spoken at a soup conference. But it was like old home week, you know. Mm-hmm. The Govies who were there and the vendors who were there all knew each other. It wasn't this great big party thing, but it was like a family reunion. It was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think the agencies should be, if they're doing their job, they should be evangelizing what they're trying to accomplish and actively seeking feedback. Mm-hmm. And I think some agencies have done better than others. When I watched the GSA Oasis acquisition, I thought GSA did a fantastic job of telling people what they wanted to accomplish, what they were trying to accomplish, why they were making some of the decisions that they were making, but still offering the opportunity to provide feedback. And it wasn't just them doing a industry day where people came out and they gave very generic presentations. It was them actively going out and speaking and presenting at different events around town and around the country to provide that, you know, active channel for people to engage.
And the types of information they were providing were not simply the scope of the vehicle, but how they would address each of the socioeconomic categories.
Yeah, and how they're planning on evaluating bidders and how they're going to select bidders for different, I can't remember what the term was with Oasis, but the different tracks or the different types of work they were procuring, how you could win certain slots. So it really gave you a good opportunity as a vendor to think about what's the gaming strategy, what's the approach that we need to take to decide how we're going to win. Do you need a big team that's very expansive? Do you need a narrow team that you're going to be really laser focused on winning a particular track and be focused on just that? Or are you going to do a joint venture? Or is that going to be held against you? I think there's all kinds of things that you have to pay attention to besides just the scope that are going to drive your teaming strategy, the way you approach your pricing, and the past performance you're going to provide as examples that are going to help you, you know, support your work and your case and your proposal.
Okay. it you know, tracking the vehicles early obviously is important. If a vehicle does not have an apparent small business angle to it, a set-aside angle to it, Should small companies be concerned? Are there particular activities that they should engage in other than, you know, picking up the phone, calling their congressman and going eek, eek?
Well, most contract vehicles that I've seen have given a lot of thought to the small business angle. And if they don't, shame on them. But I have not seen a lot of vehicles where they haven't paid attention to it. Usually the debate comes in when they're deciding what NAICS code to a slot to it because it impacts the size standards. How they're going to evaluate the small businesses. Is it going to be reserve awards or is it going to be set asides? Because that impacts whether the small business has to do a majority of the work or not. So things like that are what I normally see being the kind of critical debates and discussions around how an agency is going to handle it. If you feel like an agency is not approaching a procurement or contract vehicle correctly as it relates to small business, the best approach is to go to the OSDBU, which I think have gotten a lot more influence, the Office of Small Business disadvantaged business utilization. I think they've gotten a lot more influence in the purchasing decisions in agencies, as agencies have had a lot more pressure put on them to meet their small business goals. So I think they're probably the best venue to start with for a particular agency contract vehicle.
Okay. And historically that did not used to be the same, because the OSDBUs were more concerned with explaining kind of the lay of the land, the types of contractual vehicles that were out there, the types of products and services acquired, et cetera. They didn't handhold you to or through the procurement process.
Yeah, I mean they used to be described as that office you direct the small businesses to where there were no other doors. So you got them into a room and there was nowhere else for them to go.
There you go.
But I think that's changed quite a bit. And I think the OSDBUs have had a lot more influence. And I would say from that point of view, for the first time that I can remember, the government-wide small business goal has been achieved for 2 years running. They've beaten the 23% government-wide small business goal last year in 2013. And then again in 2014, they even improved upon it, almost getting to 25%. So
yeah, and I know some of the OSDBUs, I don't even know if they're called that anymore, but you know, you got guys like Kevin Boshiers over at DHS and Shap Drisco over at State, who are really quite proactive. I see them out there speaking. I see sometimes them out there attending events, not as speakers, but they're there to if there's any questions about their agency, they'll be there to answer them. So that's pretty cool. It's become a more proactive environment. I'm not sure I want to get into this on this segment, so we'll take a break early and take a longer final segment. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest is Kevin Plexico, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest is Kevin Plexico, who I believe official job title is now minor deity at Deltek. So... Like that?
I like that.
Okay.
You don't see that on a business card too often.
Glow. Radioactive cards. I'm not going to touch on this long, but I want to bring it up, and I'm going to ask your opinion. There was an article in GovExec recently that talked about an OMB presidential directive / OMB thing, $86 billion IT spending. We know about this, but the White House is exploring ways to expand opportunities to small, innovative companies. We've heard this before. We saw it at DHS right after 9/11, right after DHS was stood up. But what they're trying to do is get people involved in the simplified acquisition process, sort of fast lane them. Number one, technically, for a company that's never done business with the government before, is this an intelligent way to go?
The first contract you win with the federal government will almost invariably be the most expensive contract you ever win. It's going to cost you a lot of money to get that contract because of all of the overhead and the infrastructure you have to put in place in terms of processes. Whether it be, if you're a product company, like we've talked a lot about product companies with soup and that type, you know, the pricing issues that you have to navigate. Is it a commercial item? Can you demonstrate that type of stuff? To a services company, if you're doing work in the DOD where you have to, you know, deal with DCAA compliance and audits and cost accounting rules and regulations that are in the FAR. So almost any contract, the first contract you win is going to be the most expensive contract you ever win.
And for many, the last.
Yeah, well, the next one is going to be, the next one's going to cost you a lot less. And so once you're in the market and once you've laid the plumbing, it becomes easier to do more work for government customers. And that's why I believe, anyway, that when you look at companies like CACI or Lockheed or Northrop, you know, they've got down how to do business with the government. So they do this, they're like conglomerates that do, you know, everything from aircraft carriers, weapon systems, IT, health IT, cybersecurity, because they've already figured out how to do business with the government and have built the infrastructure to manage it.
Yeah. Well, the other part of the article that really caught my attention, the attention of several other consultants like myself, was that there's a new company out there, and they're not going to be named, that said they can take these novice companies from zero access to full access to the government in 6 months. Well, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and I've never seen that done. Full access to the government, I'm not quite sure what they mean by full access to the government. I've gotten companies on contracts within 6 months, but it's usually by taking them to a vendor who already has a vehicle and has a very specific need that company fills.
Yeah, I would be cynical about that. You know, we were talking about Tom Hewitt earlier, one of the titans of the industry, and he told me this analogy at one time. It's usually the third guy that a commercial company hires to get them into government that's successful. The first guy is the one telling them, we need contracts, we need GSA vehicles, et cetera. And after a year, the commercial company, you know, says, fine, we're done with you, though. We're going to go ahead and get those contracts, but we're going to move on because we don't think you know what you're talking about. They bring in the next guy. He's like, well, these great, we got these contracts, but I got to build a pipeline. It's going to take me 18 to 24 months to get a pipeline going before we win business. And they're like, okay, after a year, we're done with you. The third guy gets hired. Plumbing's been laid, pipeline's built, and now the deals start coming in, and he looks like he's the hero.
Right. So. And that's a situation. You know, if you're not ready for the long haul, you know, beginning of my last major book, Selling the Government, 24 months minimum is really
it's
going to take.
18 to 24 is a realistic objective, I think.
And that's with focus.
Exactly.
A lot of focus.
And money.
Yeah, and yeah, just a few bucks. I think the American Express Open study said it's going to average somewhere around $90,000 per year in resources and dollars to gear up for a small firm to win that first business.
But once you win it, once you're in, it's much easier to win additional dollars.
Right, and it's not any easier to make money on it given the margins right now, but that's beside the point. Not what we're talking about. You had indicated to me in the breaks that you've done some research lately. I mean, you know, the trending techs, there's no big surprise here. We have cloud, we have cyber, we have health IT mobile. Interestingly enough, you know, early this morning I got an email from a former very senior Govy saying, you know, it's really interesting to watch OMB scrambling around right now, trying to have an impact on the IT, pushing major programs at CIOs and agencies. And, you know, the last scramble and the gasps of an administration that will be gone in, you know, what, 18 months less. But that happens with every administration. He's just chuckling because he's no longer part of it. your research does what here?
So we were our common question we get from clients is, where can I find business? How can I grow? Especially in the market that we've had the last couple of years, which has been in some cases a declining market, and in some cases we'll say flat or very, very slow increase. So we did, you know, some research, because there are some companies that have continued to grow and find success. And what are the patterns in those companies that have made them successful? And there's four things that we found. One, they're doing business in agencies that have been somewhat insulated from the cuts. Like if you're in the VA, for example, obviously it was a good place to be.
Right.
CMS, with the implementation of the healthcare reform legislation.
CMS has a huge budget.
Good place to be, yeah. And so that's one. The other is providing some technology or capability that's been in high demand. So if you're, you know, a cybersecurity provider that's really good at what you do, you probably have felt very little headwind in this market. Same with health IT. We talked about that as another hot area. The third is winning a key contract vehicle and leveraging that contract vehicle to be successful. So I'll think again of there's a company out there called Systems Made Simple that won a position on the VA T4 contract as a small business, service-disabled, veteran-owned small business. They proceeded to win $300 million and $500 million task orders on that contract vehicle and just sold recently to Lockheed Martin.
How much?
$300 million and $500 million.
Small. No longer small, boys.
Yes, and now they're owned, I think, by Lockheed Martin. So that is, you know, a great example of how one of these contract vehicles can make a big difference to a business. And then the last area that we looked at is just what we've described as operational efficiency and effectiveness. You do something that gives you a competitive advantage from a pricing point of view or a service differentiation point of view that nobody else can compete with, or at least not effectively. And that might be like what Amazon's doing with the cloud services and the way it's able to offer that up to agencies for some of the public cloud areas that we've seen been very successful. Things like that that have really made a big difference for a company in terms of their ability to sell into the market.
Okay. So let's back up here. This goes back to what you were talking about earlier about, you know, how do you track a vehicle? What do you do? So let's take that last item, the differentiation aspect. How important is that, especially for the smaller companies?
It's key. I mean, differentiation, when you're a professional services company that does IT support, you know, you've just now described about half the companies in the market.
Right.
So you have to peel
about
it back.
Every third company on SAM.
Yeah, you have to peel it back more, and you have to get very specific about what it is that you do that's differentiated. And I think this is where, you know, we didn't talk about this, but the LPTA, low price technically acceptable, and some of the pricing competitiveness in the market that's come into play has played out. When agency budgets are declining, they're looking to do the same mission with less dollars, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, making them more price sensitive. At the same time, you have the same number of companies competing for fewer dollars that are fighting for every dollar they can win, even if it's at lower margin. So you're competing in this environment where, you know, the agencies are more price sensitive and there's more price competition. So I think that's kind of a function of where we've seen agencies willing to make trade-offs. And when they look at a company, describe their capabilities, and they sound just like the other three that they just had in, you're kind of reinforcing that. And I think that's where companies have fallen down is how they really articulately, clearly communicate the differentiation, and that differentiation matters to the agency. That's really the secret sauce. If you can do that, then you can really have a big impact.
Okay. What else do they need to do?
Well, I think marketing obviously is key.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be effective at communicating your differentiators, demonstrating them and how you've done it for other agencies or where you've done it for other companies, and quantifying it. So effectively, you know, I would describe it as trying as best you can to make the business case for the agency, for the CIO, so they don't have to do the battle and the hard and heavy lifting to build that business case themselves. The more you can make their business case for them, the easier it is for them to kind of leverage you and sell you internally.
Okay. How important is the program team that you present on these vehicles?
Well, it depends on how the Section M or the evaluation is written. Are they going to be evaluating the partners or just your past performance? That was kind of an interesting approach that the Oasis contract took, was we're not really thinking about how your partners perform. We're thinking about how you perform, and we want to see where you've done this work. I think the other thing is agencies like to see that when you come into a room with your partner, you and your partner aren't meeting for the first time, and that you've actually have some experience implementing with a partner. So I think where you have past performance with a partner that is part of your past performance for your proposal, it helps sell the relationship that it's been a successful relationship in the past, and it's not just the first time you happen to be working together.
You don't swap business grudge in front of the CEO.
Yeah, or shake hands and say, oh, hi, John, what's your name?
I'm not trying to sell your service here, but the HR portion of the business that you just brought on, could that potentially help especially the small contractors that they're in their staff up mode?
Yeah, I think it's designed to help with everything from the recruiting process and making that efficient and making it helpful to navigate which people do you want to bring in and how do you make them align to what you do. And then once you bring them in, how do you manage them from a performance point of view to make sure you're rewarding the best performers and either working the lowest performers out of the business or finding a way to improve them. And obviously, for a lot of services companies, the people is the lifeblood of the business. If you don't have good people, you don't have a business. And yeah. And that's obviously what we're trying to accomplish for our government contracting clients.
There you go. Give me some final thoughts here on what people should be looking for over particularly this fiscal year and into the next.
Well, I think this one, obviously the big question is going to be what happens with the sequester. That's going to create a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt as we go in later in the year if it doesn't get taken off the table. What we're sort of hearing at this point is we're likely to get something like the bipartisan budget agreement that we had the last 2 years that maybe that gets kind of put back in place for another couple years, which would be, I think, great for the industry. At least it kicks the problem to the next election, which you could sort of see as being, you know, kind of as far as we can think of.
Typical sport here in D.C.
Yeah, we think of two-year windows here. So I think that's the big one to watch. I think the cybersecurity area, you know, we're seeing breaches all the time. We're seeing issues with that all the time. And I think we're going to see more and more legislation, more and more emphasis on that. So that's still going to be, I think, a really hot area going forward. And the other one, I think, is what happens with the entitlement programs. That's probably 2 or 3 years out. But obviously, the entitlement programs and our tax policies are at odds with each other. The tax policy is insufficient to fund the commitments that we've made in the entitlement programs of Medicare and Medicaid. And so far, the resolution to that has been, let's cut or shrink discretionary spending, but that's only going to buy you time.
Band-aid for a bleeder.
Yeah, so at some point, that issue is going to rise to the front, and we'll have to see how that impacts the contracting community.
Thanks for coming in, man.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it, as usual.
Always a pleasure. You've been listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is not my day job. If you need help on that differentiation side or the marketing side, give me a call. I do host seminars, workshops every month in Columbia, Maryland. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.